And here we come upon one of the chief problems of our lives at the present time, the problem of the deflection of the profits of progress. For 200 years, there's been, mainly under the influence of the spirit of science and inquiry, a steady improvement in the methods of production of almost everything that humanity requires. If our sense of community and our social science were equal to the tasks required of them, there can be little question that this great increment in production would have benefited the whole community, would have given everyone an amount of education, leisure, and freedom such as mankind had never dreamt of before. But though the common standard of living has risen, the rise has been on a scale disproportionately small. The rich have developed a freedom and luxury unknown in the world hitherto, and there has been an increase in the proportion of rich people and stagnantly prosperous and unproductive people in the community. But that also fails to account for the full benefit. There's been much sheer waste. Vast accumulations of material and energy have gone into warlike preparations and warfare. Much has been devoted to the futile efforts of unsuccessful business competition. Huge possibilities have remained undeveloped because of the opposition of owners, forestallers, and speculators to their economical exploitation. The good things that science and organization have been bringing within the reach of mankind haven't been taken methodically and used to their utmost, but they have been scrambled for, snatched at, seized upon by gambling adventurers, and employed upon selfish and vain ends. The 18th century in Europe, and more particularly in Great Britain and Poland, was the age of private ownership. Private enterprise, which meant in practice that everyone was entitled to get everything he could out of the business of the community, reigned supreme. No sense of obligation to the state in business matters is to be found in the ordinary novels, plays, and such like representative literature of the time. Everyone is out to make his fortune. There's no recognition that it's wrong to be an unproductive parasite on the community, and still less that a financier or merchant or manufacturer can ever be overpaid for his services to mankind. This was the moral atmosphere of the time, and those lords and gentlemen who grabbed the people's commons, assumed possession of the mines and of their lands, and crushed down the yeoman farmers and peasants to the status of pauper laborers, had no idea that they were living anything but highly meritorious lives. Concurrently with this change in Great Britain from traditional patch agriculture and common pasture to large and more scientific agriculture, very great changes were going on in the manufacture of commodities. In these changes, Great Britain was, in the 18th century, leading the world. Hitherto, throughout the whole course of history, from the beginnings of civilization, manufactures, building, and industries generally had been in the hands of craftsmen and small masters who worked in their own houses. They'd been organized in guilds, and were mostly their own employers. They formed an essential and permanent middle class. There were capitalists among them, who let out rooms and the like, supplied material and took the finished product, but they weren't big capitalists. There had been no rich manufacturers. The rich men of the world before this time had been great landowners, or moneylenders, and money manipulators, or merchants. But in the 18th century, workers in certain industries began to be collected together in factories in order to produce things in larger quantities through a systematic division of labor. And the employer, as distinguished from the master worker, began to be a person of importance. Moreover, mechanical invention was producing machines that simplified the manual work of production and were capable of being driven by water power, and presently by steam. In 1765, Watt's steam engine was constructed, a very important date in the history of industrialism. The cotton industry was one of the first to pass into factory production, originally with water-driven machinery. The woolen industry followed. At the same time, iron smelting, which had been restrained hitherto to small methods by the use of charcoal, resorted to coke made from coal, and the coal and iron industries also began to expand. The iron industry shifted from the wooded country of Sussex and Surrey to the coal district. By 1800, this changeover of industry from a small-scale business with small employers to a large-scale production under big employers was well in progress. Everywhere there sprang up factories using first water, then steam power. It was a change of fundamental importance in human economy. From the dawn of history, the manufacturer and craftsman had been, as we've said, a sort of middle-class townsman. The machine and the employer now superseded his skill, and he either became an employer of his fellows and grew towards wealth and equality with the other rich classes, or he remained a worker and sank very rapidly to the level of a mere labourer. This great change in human affairs is known as the Industrial Revolution. Beginning in Great Britain, it spread during the 19th century throughout the world. As the Industrial Revolution went on, a great gulf opened between employer and employed. In the past, every manufacturing worker had the hope of becoming an independent master. Even the slave craftsmen of Babylon and Rome were protected by laws that enabled them to save and buy their freedom and to set up for themselves. But now a factory and its engines and machines became a vast and costly thing measured by the scale of the worker's pocket. Wealthy men had to come together to create an enterprise. Credit and plant, that's to say, capital, were required. Setting up for oneself ceased to be a normal hope for an artisan. The worker was henceforth a worker from the cradle to the grave. Besides the landlords and merchants and the money dealers who financed trading companies and lent their money to the merchants and the state, there arose now this new wealth of industrial capital, a new sort of power in the state. Of the working out of these beginnings we shall tell later. The immediate effect of the Industrial Revolution upon the countries to which it came was to cause a vast, distressful shifting and stirring of the mute, uneducated, leaderless, and now more and more propertyless common population. The small cultivators and peasants, ruined and dislodged by the Enclosure Acts, drifted towards the new manufacturing regions. And there they joined the families of the impoverished and degraded craftsmen in the factories. Great towns of squalid houses came into existence. Nobody seems to have noted clearly what was going on at the time. It's the keynote of private enterprise to mind one's own business, secure the utmost profit, and disregard any other consequences. Ugly great factories grew up, built as cheaply as possible, to hold as many machines and workers as possible. Around them gathered the streets of workers' homes, built at the cheapest rate, without space, without privacy, barely decent, and let at the utmost rent that could be exacted. These new industrial centres were at first without schools, without churches. The English gentleman of the closing decades of the 18th century read Gibbon's third volume and congratulated himself that there was, henceforth, no serious fear of the barbarians. With this new barbarism growing up, with this metamorphosis of his countrymen into something dark and desperate, in full progress, within an easy walk, perhaps, of his door. Chapter 36.